Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Ray Bengo. Ray is a developer evangelist from Microsoft, focusing on standards-based web development. He's a former member of the jQuery project team, and he's a big advocate for HTML5 and CSS3. It says here he also loves freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. How are you, Ray?
Good, Jesse. Good to talk to you again. It's been quite a long time.
It has. Erstwhile teammates we were. And on that team, when I was at Microsoft and we were on the same team, was John Galloway. So we have John with us as well.
Yep. It's the reunion.
So, Ray, what's your focus these days?
Yeah, it's funny because when you and I were on the same team, our focus was around content generation. And obviously, we were focused on two very different things. But my initially was Script Junkie and getting a lot of HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript content out there. And then that was when I was under the kind of like the MSDN flag. Mm-hmm. And then I joined the evangelism team. We call it DPE internally. And it's worked out great because I'm focused primarily on web development technologies. So, you know, I focus on every day on HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript. I get to work with the IE engineering team on many occasions to figure out how can we make the browser great? How can we ease some of the pain that developers have? And obviously, there's a lot of history there. And so the good thing for me, at least, is that I'm coming in at a great time where our browsers, IE9 and soon IE10, are really looking great. And they're modern browsers supporting web standards.
And is there a significant difference between IE9 and 10?
I can't say there's a significant difference. Well, you know, the thing is, I don't like to use the word significant because that's always in the eye of the beholder. Me, it's a substantial difference because the amount of features, HTML5 features, we're adding in there. What I do like is the fact that we're still very much on this path of web standards, and that's the critical part. Features are fantastic, and giving new eye candy and toys to developers is always great. But making sure that we're on a path, what I call the righteous path, I guess, to promote same markup and to allow developers to leverage these great HTML5 features the right way is what makes me happy.
One of the huge advantages to using that technology for building Windows 8 applications is that you have to build only for one browser. If you're building a Windows 8 application using JavaScript and HTML, you only have to build for IE10. But it sounds like what you're saying is if you're building for the web, that this is much more within standards, and so you're still not going to have too big a headache in terms of meeting other browsers.
Right, and you know, the great thing is that when you build for Windows 8, you still get to leverage those HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript features, the standards-based features, so the skills that you currently have for building these great websites can carry over to building great Windows 8 apps. The thing is that when you're building for the web and your consumer base could be it's going to be varied. It doesn't matter what type of site you are. You're going to have some users who are going to use Internet Explorer and of course the various versions of Internet Explorer that are there. You're going to have some that are going to like Chrome and some that are going to love Firefox and some that are going to use Opera and Safari. So you have multiple targets out there. And then that's not even really considering the number of diverse geos out there. I think. I haven't looked recently, but I know that in China, for example, one of the most popular browsers is a browser called Macthon. It's spelled Maxthon. And that's another one that has to consider that. And what they offer is something pretty interesting because you can use both the IE Triton engine and WebKit. So it's kind of neat, but I don't know how compatible they are. So those are things that you, as a web developer, you have to consider. What's your target audience? What are they using? You have to look at your stats and figure out which browsers I need port so that you can make your site cross-browser and appeal to the broadest audience possible.
You know, I was just going to say that's a factor I hadn't really considered, that as 1 billion people come online with their browsers, they're going to be able to influence popularity.
Oh, absolutely. It's more than just even influencing popularity. It's addressing their specific consumer needs. Every consumer is different. You have consumers that range from incredibly savvy to tech savvy to somebody who's just starting off computers, and they're going to choose the software that makes them the most comfortable. And you have to be able to accommodate for that on the web, and you have to be able to give them a good experience. One of the things that I think developers fall prey to is wanting to build the same exact experience across every single browser, including some of the non-modern ones. And that's something that developers don't need to do. They need to get out of this this thing, that this perception, that's the only way that they can build decent websites. Now, obviously, there's customer considerations in there. If your customer is saying, I'm going to pay you X amount of money to build a site exactly the same way, well, if you've accepted that, then that's kind of your responsibility. But if not, if your customer is, or your employer or even your own company is flexible enough to say, all right, if I'm in IE6, I can't do something like Flexbox, so I'm going to offer a different experience, that's fine. That's not that. There's nothing wrong with that. Not giving the same exact experience. There's nothing wrong with that. That's why we came up with paradigms like progressive enhancement and graceful degradation to give developers that flexibility to offer a different experience based on their target, the targets.
And I think that a lot of that comes from focusing on content versus I see a lot of people approach web design and development as if it was print and bringing so much baggage over, and like you're saying, it doesn't have to look the same because your users aren't sitting there like the pointy headed bosses may be looking, hey, it looks different in this browser than this one. But your users never do that. They want the content and that's all that's important. Or the experience. They want the site to work or they want to be able to read their news or whatever.
That's a great point, John. And content is king. And it's funny that's such a cliched term, but it's the truth. That's what users want. Ultimately, they want to be able to go to their site. They want to know that they can pull it up and they're going to get the content that they need. If you can make it visually appealing and really tweak it out, that's great. That's awesome. I mean, I've seen everybody complains about Craigslist. I use this as a great example because you look at their site and it looks like a site back in the early 1990s. But the interesting part about it is that for the most part, you can get the information you want in a very easy to use format. Now, could somebody take that and really make it into a spruced up super duper HTML5 powered website? Absolutely. And it probably looks stunning. Especially, when you look at some of the people out there like an Ethan Marcotte or a Trent Walton, those guys are like, they're animals at design. And what they could do with something like that would be amazing. But the bottom line is users will dictate how the site should, their demands will dictate whether you need to actually enhance your site, whether you need to go that extra step and add that extra whiz bang feature. Sometimes it's necessary, sometimes it's not. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that you don't need to go hog wild, but I always recommend that you go with standards.
Well, I just brought up Craigslist on my machine, and I see why you use it as an example, because it's brutal, but it's also clearly functional. And it must be working for him.
Yeah, I love scuba diving equipment, and I'm always, I'm always on the hunt for something. I look to see if somebody might have a use, whatever, a BC or maybe some fins that they just don't want, especially because it'd be great to get my daughter certified. And, the cost of scuba equipment is incredibly expensive. So anybody with a hobby can kind of relate to them. What I love is that I can go to Craigslist. I can click on my region, type in a specific topic, and it brings it up for me. There's no fancy schmancy stuff going along. It's straightforward. It's a straightforward user experience, which I love. And, you look at some other sites, and I look at the Microsoft.com site. Total contrast, but the attention to detail and the attention to user experience is fantastic. And the fact that the team took time to incorporate things like responsive web design and leverage features of HTML5 and CSS3 responsibly makes that website fantastic. It's another example of a website that I truly love.
Yeah. So, you're talking about, responsibly leveraging newer modern features. There's new things coming out all the time. There's different support. And a lot of these are, I guess browsers have been good at, like we're talking about Craigslist, at displaying content that we need, but we can improve the experience. And so what are some ways you'd recommend to a developer that wants to, have a great baseline, but then, take advantage of HTML5 or things that aren't even out yet or starting to roll out? How do you do that responsibly?
Sure. And that's where I consider it's kind of like a compatibility thing. Unfortunately, developers have had to use like browser hacks for quite some time, primarily to support non-modern browsers like IE6 and IE7. And, that was the fact of life back then, because you are talking about, at least a 10-year-old browser in IE6. And back then, IE6 was the best browser available. And some users haven't had the opportunity to upgrade modern browser, and that's why sometimes you have to support them. But to be able to leverage the feature responsibility, that's where the concept of progressive enhancement comes in. That's the one I like to kind of talk about and approach or profess because advocate for, because it's such a great way of building websites. It's basically saying, hey, let's start off with a baseline where we know that this specific browser, let's say it's IE6 or IE7, maybe even IE8, we know that it works great here. The user has a fantastic experience, but if they're using a more modern browser, then let's use feature detection to go ahead and sprinkle the really good stuff on there. And it might be saying, let's use border radius to do rounded corners. Or maybe we're going to use some kind of transitions to do some animation. Or it could be maybe we're going to use IndexedDB for offline storage. But to me, it's creating the baseline functionality for your minimum browser requirement and then enhancing it based on the more advanced features available to your browser. And you use feature detection for that. A lot of people tend to lean towards user agent sniffing. And that's kind of a bad way of doing it, because if something ever gets deprecated, something ever gets changed, and you're sniffing for a browser, that's kind of like that's a recipe for failure. With a feature detection scheme, you're ensuring whether a specific feature that you want to leverage is there. And if it's not, well, you know, you can't use it. And then you're going to use something else. Maybe it's going to be a polyfill or a shim to kind of mimic the functionality. But if it is, at least you know, all right, now I can drop in the file API or drag and drop it. You know, that's kind of the approach I tend to advocate.
Is a shim a general approach to code that manages the gap between two different platforms, or is a shim in this usage something more specific than that?
Right. So typically that's the way that I think you hit it right on the head, Jesse. It's something that I talk about, and I used to advocate a lot for it, but I, you know, as more and more I try to preach more about responsible code management. And I'll tell you why. So let's first define what a shim and a polyfill are, because that's going to be the best way of kicking this off. So both of them, what they try to do is mimic standards-based functionality. So let's say you wanted to do WebSockets. Well, you know, before there was a library called Socket.io, and Socket.io would give you the socket-based functionality with the content of a browser. And the initial versions of Socket.io didn't match the standards API. So if you go to the W3C and you look up, you know, WebSockets or whatever it is, and you look at the API, that API didn't match what WebSockets had. So you can consider WebSockets a shim because it doesn't match the API, although it provides similar functionality. Now, Socket.io actually matches the API directly. So because it matches the API directly, it's what we now can refer to as a polyfill. A polyfill, both shims and polyfills fill the gaps, but a polyfill matches the API, the web standards API, directly. So what I like to do is, first of all, tell developers that if you need to use a polyfill or a shim, you should really inspect the code and make sure that it meets your needs. And number two, that you can actually manage that code. Because if the developer who built that code decides he wants to abandon the project or gets hit by a bus, ultimately that responsibility to manage that code falls on you. So if you can manage it, you think it's good, you think it's solid code and it meets your needs, then I would always say try to lean towards a polyfill. Because since it matches the standards API, when that feature becomes available in another browser, making sure that your code runs without code change is a lot easier with a polyfill.
Right, that makes sense, because you should be able to just drop in the functionality and drop out the polyfill, and it should continue to work.
That's exactly it, yep.
So, Ray, and we talk about this from time to time as we run across sites that should work and don't because they're doing user agent sniffing or, you know, bad practices, basically. One thing that I like, I wonder if you could talk about, or if you know more about it, is this IE Compat Inspector.
Yeah, I could talk a little about it. You want me to go into it right now?
Sure, yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought I cut you off in the middle of the
I should have asked a little better. But.
Yes, but so, you know, when one of the things that we wanted to do was ensure that developers had as many tools as possible to get their site ready for IE9 and for IE10. And compatibility was one of the big issues. With all so many sites doing browser hacks and conditional comments specific to Internet Explorer browsers, invariably, when we started talking about same markup and standards-based development, we had a feeling that there might be some patterns that might cause problems to getting your site to a standards-based, point. So what the IE team did was they identified key patterns and problems, and they could be problems associated with, let's say, libraries that haven't been updated in a while, like, let's say, old versions of jQuery that they knew would cause an issue. Or it could be features that were deprecated. For example, in IE10, we don't support conditional comments any longer, and there are some other properties that have been kind of deprecated. So what the Compat Inspector does, and this is a cool thing about it, it's just a JavaScript file that you drop into the head of your application, your website, and it'll pop up in the upper right-hand corner, and it actually looks at your code as it's running and determines if there's any things that you should address. And it will actually show it to you in a really clear, concise way. The best part about it is that you can verify if the bugs are actually because of if they're regressions based on older versions, and you can also debug them interactively with the F12 tools. It's a great tool to making sure that you can leverage web standards and push, make sure your site is ready for the newest versions of IE. Now, one other thing that I want to point out, and I'm sure most people use some kind of HTTP sniffer. And if you're in Windows, for example, you have Fiddler, Service Capture, Charles. And if you're on another platform, let's say Mac or even Linux, you have Charles or you have Wireshark or whatever it is. The cool thing about using Fiddler, which was created by Eric Lawrence, who used to work at Microsoft and now works at Telerik with you, Jesse.
Sure.
Eric enabled this functionality where Compatibility Inspector and Fiddler can be tied in together. And what that means is that if you say enable Compat Inspector, when Fiddler starts reading HTTP traffic, it can automatically inject Compat Inspector in the page so that you don't have to update your code to do it. This is done automatically for you. It just injects it via request. So it's kind of neat. And it just makes your life easier.
Are there any other tools that you'd recommend for, you know, that are similar to this kind of thing for checking out, you know, for looking at your code or looking at things and saying and identifying problems?
Oh, sure. You know, every browser comes with a set of developer tools. It's funny because I talk to so many web developers that don't realize that Internet Explorer actually has developer tools. And yes, it does. And if you press the F12 key on Internet Explorer, you're going to get a really feature-rich set of developer tools. A lot of developers know that there's the Firebug plugin or the Firefox add-on for Mozilla Firefox. You have the Chrome Web Developer Tools. Safari has the Web Inspector Tools. And even Opera has Dragonfly, which are great tools to use. So those are the tools that I recommend. I'm very partial to cross-browser development. Whenever you see me blog about anything, talk about anything, I focus on cross-browser development because ultimately that's what the web is about. I like to have the largest reach possible. So I'm glad that every major developer or every major browser has developer tools. So with all of them, I can inspect network traffic. I can inspect the DOM. I can change CSS styles interactively so I can see how it affects my page. I can debug JavaScript code. I can profiling. There's a lot of great feature sets. So the developer tools are a critical part of that.
So one area that I used to, or that I'm starting to see now, it used to be always that the frustrations I ran into were in JavaScript because somebody was saying, if it's IE, it doesn't support SVG, or if it's IE, it does this, you know, it's all that just kind of poor JavaScript. But now there's also the browser or the CSS, gosh, I'm forgetting the name, the CSS...
Vendor prefixes.
Yes, I love them so much. And so, you know, like I ran into one just the other week on GitHub where it was like, why is this not doing an animation in IE10? Because I know it supports it. You know, it's not doing the transition. I noticed, well, it only has the WebKit vendor prefix.
Yep.
I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I really wish we could do away with vendor prefixes. I know the reason that they're there, and I respect those reasons. I respect the rationale for doing it. The problem is that there are certain browser vendors that don't respect the reasons that they're there for. And so what that ends up doing is causing problems for developers. I can't really blame developers all the time for this because it's a dual responsibility. I think some developers are just don't worry about the impact of leveraging a vendor prefix feature in a production environment, especially if it's not a standard. And developers target WebKit-specific vendor prefixes. That's the big one right there. They'll go ahead and use features that, let's say, Apple I like to say Apple because Apple, you know, puts in a lot of features into WebKit. You know, they'll put in a lot of features in there that are vendor prefix and will never become a standard. But it's useful to them, and it's useful to maybe iOS, for example. And so what ends up happening is that developers look at it and say, oh, wow, this is a neat feature. I'm going to use it. And they put it into a production environment. Well, guess what? It breaks everywhere else. Or in some cases, they just want to target one specific browser, and it doesn't work on any other browser except for WebKit. To me, that's analogous to going back into when we had best viewed in Internet Explorer or best viewed in Netscape. And I don't know. I don't see the value in that because the ability to create a cross-browser site nowadays is substantially easier than it was at any period in time. You have the materials out there that tell you how to do it. There's excellent documentation out there explaining what's a standard and what's not. You know, we just launched the webplatforms.org site, which is very clear on explaining what is a standard and what's not. And if developers took a little time to figure that out, they could very easily make cross-browser websites. It just feels like some developers aren't worrying about that. It's not all of them. I don't want to generalize it. It's just some. And unfortunately, sometimes those are very high-profile sites that are getting launched with a WebKit-only environment. So I guess if we all want to go back to, hey, best viewed in, you know, in whatever browser, maybe it's going to be WebKit, then, you know, I don't know. I personally think that's a pretty bad place to be in.
Let's take a step back. And we were talking about standards and IE9 and IE10. And with that, obviously, HTML5. When I took a look, and I am not an HTML guy, but when I took a look at HTML5 not all that long ago, it struck me as a set of disparate pieces as opposed to a coherent standard for development. There were specific enhancements to HTML, but not a whole body of here's how you sit down and learn this thing called HTML5. Has it evolved past that at this point? Is it now, if I were going to sit down and try to become conversant with this, would I be learning a coherent set of features and capabilities?
So like any type of specification, you're going to have a period of time where things are evolving and it's kind of like in a state of flux. And sometimes it feels overwhelming because you have so many things going on. I mean, you look back at any programming language and it's kind of that's kind of the way it evolves. You know, it happened like, you know, Python, I think of Python 3, you know, I'm not a Python developer, but I've read up enough about it to know that there were substantial differences between Python 2.x and 3.0. And I'm sure, and John, tell me if I'm right or not, but, you know, if you look at the .NET framework, I'm sure that between, let's say, version 1.0 and 4.0, there have been substantial changes and new things that you need to learn about.
Sure.
Yeah, so it's just an evolutionary thing. And so the great thing about it is that with HTML, now there's books and so much reference material on HTML5 that somebody who really wanted to understand features that are, you know, are useful nowadays can actually do it. And again, I'm referring to the webplatform.org site because that's going to be a fantastic site to understand what is a good, stable feature to use today. How do you use it? What are the best practices? Here's some code samples. Go ahead and put it into your site.
Let's just grab that site. It's webplatform1word.org.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'll go with you. So if you hear me typing, that's where I'm going. Mm-hmm. So the great thing about webplatform.org mm-hmm. is that it's a community effort. It's being vetted by very large organizations that have kicked it off and contributed information to it. And, you know, Microsoft is on that list along with Apple and Adobe, Facebook, Google, HP, Mozilla, Nokia, Opera, and the W3C. And what they've done is they've gotten, you know, a lot of information and contributed towards this effort so that developers can find a central place to get the best and most up-to-date information. Not only on, let's say, IE or, Firefox, but just on standards. So this is a great resource for developers to get up to speed on the features that are important.
That seems like an incredibly powerful resource and supported by virtually all the significant players. So
yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
You know, I like that. Originally, I assumed that it was just going to be kind of a documentation of a bunch of, you know, what's supported and how does the feature work, which is really good. But then I also noticed that there's on the docs that there's concepts listed. And there's some really good concepts here, like explaining how the internet works or why to use standards or, you know, accessibility or things like that are just really good things that you'd want to point a beginning web developer at to say, here's the right way to approach web development.
Yep, exactly. You know, to me, what really gets me excited about this is the fact that it's going to be a vetted site. It's going to be a curated site. It's not something that's just going to kind of sit there and you're going to have this sinkhole of documents that never get updated. That's the important part because it's changed so rapidly. You look at the internet and every day it seems like there's new libraries, a new pattern, a new concept that developers have to learn. And sometimes trying to navigate that, trying to get through this wealth of information and trying to figure out what's a good route to follow and what's kind of like, well, that's fringe. Maybe I don't want to go down that route. That's hard. That's hard. Every day, even in the, you know, you look at things like there's a new library for, I don't know, scrolling images while they scratch your back, you know, that type of stuff. So trying to be able to really filter out what's important and what's not is critical. And I'm glad that it's here because at the very least, when it comes to web standards and supported browser technologies, this is going to be the premier site. That makes me incredibly excited.
So how on earth do you get all these different you know, different companies to agree. I mean, it's great that it's collaborative because, like you've said, everybody's kind of have their own separate, you know, silos of documentation that are specific to their browser. And then you've had these other websites that are just kind of volunteer sort of things that have sprung up. So now this is a great place to have, like you said, it's vetted and curated. How do you get people to agree on this content?
Yeah, I think a lot of pizza.
That's the right answer.
Fair enough.
That's the universal techie answer.
I think a lot of pizza. You just really just lock, you know, a bunch of developers in a room, say pizza. Everybody goes into a food coma, and then you just fake their signature. But no, seriously, I don't know all the details about how they came in on all the documentation. There was a lot of parts on this, a lot of different groups involved. I'm just glad they did it, and I ultimately think it's just a realization that in order for developers to truly understand how to leverage these features, there has to be a center place for it. It can't be, let me pull up Bing or let me pull up Google and then do these endless searches that take you to endless blogs or sites that have irrelevant or out of date or just basically inaccurate information. It's important to have a good place that developers can count on. And I think overall, you look at the companies involved in this project, they're companies with a very strong interest in the success of the internet. And in order to be able to continue to grow the internet, they need solid, knowledgeable developers. You can have all the consumers on earth hit the internet, but the bottom line is that if you don't have good websites, you don't have good apps, the consumer experience is going to be useless. You just think about how far we've gone from the mid-90s to now. It's night and day. You know, when I used to surf the web back in the late 90s, it was, you know, these text-based things, and you had, you know, marquee all over the place, and you had animated GIF buttons and, you know, things like that. And
I miss those.
Yeah, I miss them like I miss a nail in the head. But anyways, you know, think about that and how far we've gone, and the fact that in many cases, you can build things that are as compelling on the web as they are on the desktop. And that's a pretty powerful statement. So, you know, I'm just glad that there was consensus. I'm glad that smart people at very smart companies said, all right, we're going to get together and we're going to get it done. And they did.
All right, I got a provocative question for you, which is that I spend most of my time, 90-some-odd% of my time, thinking client, thinking Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8 and not thinking web. And I feel like the web is this speeding train, and everything that I knew 7-8 years ago when I was building ASP.NET applications is out the window. So am I missing the boat here, and is it time for me to go back and pay much more attention to the web?
You know, I don't think your skills have gone by the wayside, Jesse. Not at all. I still see a lot of developers that are building fantastic sites using the same stack that they've been for several years. It's not to say that you can't. It's to say that you need to really start considering how you're going to evolve yourself as a developer in the next several years. You look at things like Node.js, and you know, Node is picking up tremendous steam as a server-side technology. The fact that you'd be able to use JavaScript both on the server side and the client side is really, really compelling to a lot of developers. So it means that they don't have to learn, let's say, Ruby to get a server-side part of it done, while they have to be experts in JavaScript to have a really nice front end. And as a developer, and your .NET, your ASP.NET skills are still incredibly valuable. I the other day there was something, Charlie Kindle, who used to work at Microsoft, posted something about a new site that he's backing called Mile Logger. Logs your miles for tax purposes. And I thought it was actually a really well done site. And I asked him, so what's your stack? And he said, it's ASP.NET, and he's running it on Azure and some other. It was just like a full Microsoft stack. It was like ASP.NET with Knockout and Azure on the back end and, you know, SQL Server and stuff like that. So it's not that. It's like anything. You have to kind of look at what's going on and make some decisions to evolve. And it might mean getting a little bit stronger on the client side, for example, or maybe jumping into Node a little bit just in case.
Fair enough. John, you said strangled there, so go ahead.
Yeah, I like what you said earlier about, you know, like, well, has there been a change in .NET from 1.0 to 4.5 now? And sure, there has. But basically, everything that you know in the previous, like, there are new features and new things available, but that old code and old knowledge applies. And I think the same as we were talking about, like, I think that you could build Craigslist using 10-year-old technology. You can layer everything, and it works on all modern browsers, and then you can layer on new features as you want. But yep. I like you know, that it's all additive.
It is. I look back at my server-side experience, and I was very heavy into server-side development before I got into client-side development. And that experience was with ColdFusion. And I look at what ColdFusion developers are doing nowadays, and it's much more advanced than what I was doing back then. And so the concepts of MVC and having an ORM and object-oriented development and things like that, I still talk to some of those guys, and they're all seriously into that. And those skills are applicable to any new technology. Now, some of them are obviously making sure that they continue to enhance their skills. They're looking at technologies like Ruby on Rails or Python or even PHP, but they're trying to enhance their skills so they can be much more valuable in the workplace. It's not that they want to abandon what they like, because the same way there's a lot of ColdFusion developers that love ColdFusion and are passionate about it, and but same way there's a lot of .NET developers that are passionate about that and Ruby on Rails and etc. They just know that they need to enhance their skills because the market's changing.